Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the appeals court ruling overturning the criminal convictions in the state probation department hiring scandal.
The legislature ought not take a victory lap because we cannot go backwards in this state.
Also today, an MBA professor who tells her students they should prepare for a life that does not include a 9-to-5 job.
The best advice that I can think of to tell my students is to stop looking for a job and think about joining the gig economy.
Plus, remembering the early days of the AIDS epidemic in Boston.
I got into magical thinking, believing that it was an illness that was in New York and in San Francisco, but it didn't have anything to do with me until it became right in my face.
Michael Ward's new memoir about the loss of his partner. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A federal appeals court has thrown out the criminal convictions of three former Massachusetts Probation Department officials 6 years after a questionable hiring system was exposed in the probation department. The court said that while former probation commissioner John O'Brien and his top deputies, Elizabeth Tavares and William Burke, did not properly run the department, there were no federal crimes committed in giving jobs to politically connected candidates. To get a sense of some of the ramifications of this ruling, we spoke earlier with criminal defense attorney Brad Bailey, who's also a former prosecutor. We also spoke with former state attorney general Scott Harshbarger. I started by asking Bailey, who represented Tavares, for his reaction to the ruling.
I'm delighted for my client Liz Tavares, who spent 30 years dedicating herself as a professional in the corrections field and in probation. And the fact that they have shown that she did not engage in any wrongdoing or criminal conduct is justice delayed, but certainly justice well deserved for her.
Maybe not wrongdoing on the part of federal law, but the court also said that the department, that the officials misran the department. I actually wasn't sure that was a word until I read the ruling, but also they called what was happening in the department distasteful, that there definitely was a rigged system going on there. So what do you say to that, Brad? I mean, it wasn't pretty. It may not have technically violated federal law, but it certainly wasn't the way the system was supposed to work.
Well, it's like sausage making, and it isn't pretty, but patronage has been a part of state government here in Massachusetts for as long as I've been here in Massachusetts and beyond me. And what the First Circuit said is, look, if you don't like how the state does its hiring practices, don't take federal statutes and try to force round pegs into square holes. No matter how distasteful you may have found the practices, it wasn't criminal under federal law.
Let's focus on that, because the key here is that this did not vindicate in any way the individuals involved or the system that was involved here. A very clearly a pay-to-play system, a patronage system that ran for years. The system was rigged. Recommendations were changed, that they were changed in order to give a favoritism to people recommended by legislators and others. The court condemned that, but perhaps rightly said, this is not a federal criminal violation, as Brad is pointing out, and he's exactly right about that. But that does not mean it was right. The fact of the matter is, this is a serious ethical and moral violation, in addition to which, just a failed set of leadership for years within the system. Patronage hiring tainted the entire probation system. You know as well as I did that Massachusetts went from being a national leader in probation in leadership and pioneering efforts and innovation, and over the 10-year period became essentially a patronage haven. And so you're not wrong. I don't mean that, and I understand what the law is. What the point here is, this is about the question of what are the core, how is the state government going to function? It is not a necessary part of state government that patronage is not essential to make the wheels grind here. So the point is, patronage may well not be a federal crime, but does not make it the right thing to do.
But vindication is appropriate because these people were charged with crimes, and they were convicted with crimes, and very serious ones. There isn't a federal crime that's applicable, and there isn't a state crime that's applicable. If you're saying, which you've said for a long time and consistently and been a leader on, that this is an ethical issue and it needs to be cleaned up ethically, that's an entirely different thing.
And what I hope it's in the past, that this was a practice in Massachusetts. Probably that's naive, but the fact is, this opinion ought not to, you know, not to be a rallying cry for let's go back to the good old days when we really could influence every state agency higher if we wanted to, and if we didn't, we cut off their funding.
But even though we had this scandal in Massachusetts, there was an article about a year ago, a follow-up from the Globe Spotlight team, showing that really not that much had changed in the probation department, that there were still a lot of employees who had either been in the or hired in the old patronage system, or they benefited from it. The article named Kathleen Petrolotti, wife of the state representative Tom Petrolotti. He was called the king of patronage and had apparently a bunch of jobs linked to him in the probation department. And then also, they said in this other hiring process that had been put in place after O'Brien, there was a woman who was supremely qualified for a job, but she did not get it. Instead, that job went to someone less qualified, but who was the son of a sheriff.
Yeah.
So those things were still going on in probation. So my overall question is, how is public interest served in all of this to make sure that you are having an unrigged hiring system?
Right.
How exactly do you do that when you've still got this going on after some alleged reforms?
Because you can specifically hold people accountable, Deb, now for this. I mean, that as I said, these recommendations have been in effect. In fact, the Court Management Advisory Board has just been given a mandate by the Supreme Judicial Court to look again now 5 years later and see what issues still exist, how are the recommendations being implemented. The very case that you pointed out was that one of the decisions that was made, rightly or wrongly, as a managerial issue, was that they were not going to root out everybody in the system who had taken advantage of that, because it was, as Brad points out, it was a broken system. People, even good people in it, as John McCain used to say about the campaign finance system, it corrupts even good people in it.
Brad,
Deb, I'm all for merit hire and clean government, but the reality is a part of constituent services of elected officials and public officials is to look out for people in their constituencies and people who are off seeking jobs.
But look out is a vague term, right, Brad?
Yeah,
look out for
somebody
is a very vague term.
We do it all the way to appointments to our service academies through congressmen and congresswomen. And we are a small, tight provincial state here. And often when you have a stack of resumes, the hiring committees need to look to people that they may know, they may work with, who say, yes, I know this person, and this person would be a good fit, or I endorse this person, or I put my name behind that. That's good patronage. Yes, there's bad patronage, but there's also good patronage, and you're never going to root that out, because sometimes that's the only way to make a discerning decision.
If what this ruling says is that this did not cross a federal line, and it cites a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned the conviction of the former Virginia governor, Robert McDonald, so it said, really, there's a different standard here if you want the feds policing a state agency. So if... I'd like to understand a little bit more of how the feds got to do this in the first place, and why didn't the state attorney general's office take this over, if that would be the appropriate place? And if not the feds, then who? Scott Harshbarger.
Well, the United States attorney has, in many cases, essentially taken over the role of being the prosecutor of public corruption in Massachusetts, because for a long time the statutes in Massachusetts were the weakest felonies were public corruption and white collar crime. That wasn't an accident. The feds have tended to criminalize conduct that otherwise should be dealt with, in my view, as ethics violations, or should be dealt with by state and local prosecutors who are elected and accountable to the people. In this case, the United States Attorney did what she felt was the appropriate thing to do, and I credit her for doing that. I think people in the State House ought to think about, why is it that the United States Attorney feels that he or she has to come in to police state government in Massachusetts? And that means that we have to give the appropriate power to do these to the state attorney general, to our prosecutors, and deal with this seriously. And that's up to the legislature and the governor as well. So,
Scott, let me interrupt you. You're a former attorney general.
Yes,
did
I
you
am.
Feel that you did not have the power to take on something like this? Would you not have been able to have prosecuted a case against?
Based on the facts, you would make a judgment of whether you had the criminal power to, in Massachusetts. What you don't have in that, for example, the prosecutor does not have a RICO power, does not have sort of the mail fraud statute with the broad authority the federal prosecutors have is far greater than the state attorney general. And to some extent, we're still one of the few states that doesn't give our state prosecutors broad powers equivalent to what the federal statutes have. And the state prosecutors face an awful lot greater difficulty in taking these cases on, because if they don't succeed, they absolutely pay a political price. If they take on these cases, the people prosecuted never forget, their friends never forget, and you bear the scars, and to some extent, you just simply have to believe it's the right thing to do, and those are judgment calls you make. But there are, in my view, these are cases that ought to be primarily responsibility of state attorneys general and district attorneys and the ethics commission. But you can't stop for the United States Attorney from taking over cases if they choose to.
Brad Bailey, could possibly the defendants file suit against the federal prosecutors? Is there a case to be made here that there was overreach and this caused real harm? I mean, you represent Ms. Tavares. Is she considering any legal action?
There's no question it caused real harm across the board. There's a level of qualified immunity here, and unless you're dealing with something that could be established as a malicious prosecution, I don't see any basis for a suit. Of course, people sue on any number of grounds or for any reason. The fact that the verdicts have been reversed and my client has been acquitted is certainly going to give her the basis to look forward and not be looking back anymore.
Okay, gentlemen, great conversation. Brad Bailey, a criminal defense lawyer. He's also a former federal and state prosecutor. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Deb.
And Scott Harshberger, former Massachusetts attorney general. He's now with the firm Kasner and Edwards. Scott, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you, and congratulations, Brad.
Thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
Stay with us. Coming up, a professor who's telling her students they should stop looking for a full-time job and prepare to work in the gig economy. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Five words you probably don't expect to hear from a business school professor are stop looking for a job. Yep, that's what Diane Mulcahy tells students in her MBA classes at Babson College. Instead of applying for a conventional 9-to-5 job, she tells her students to become members of the so-called gig economy, because that, she says, is where real growth is happening. And research shows that Mulcahy may be onto something. According to a study from the Freelancers Union and Upwork, 53 million Americans, about 34% of the total workforce, are now freelancing either full-time full-time or part-time. And while some workers are happy with the flexibility, others are frustrated by a lack of benefits and predictable incomes. Diane Mulcahy is author of The Gig Economy, The Complete Guide to Getting Better Work, Taking More Time Off, and Financing the Life You Want. She's an adjunct lecturer at Babson College, where she created and teaches the MBA class Entrepreneurship and the Gig Economy. Diane, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Any of you students, would you consider going to work in the gig economy? Freelancers, are you happy without a conventional job? What are some of the benefits and what are some of the drawbacks? Is the gig economy a way of the future? Is it a way out of the cubicle? Or is it a way for employers to reduce labor costs? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So, Diane, what does gig economy really mean? Let's start with that.
That's a great place to start. And the way that I talk about the gig economy is basically anybody who is not a full-time employee in a full-time job. So if you are a contractor, a consultant, a freelancer, an on-demand worker, a part-time worker, you're in the gig economy.
But we've always had those.
We've always had those. This is not a new thing.
Right. So why are we talking about it right now? Is it more representative of our workforce? Are people more attracted to it? Why is it a bigger deal right now?
Well, there are a couple of things that are driving the growth of the gig economy. So it's definitely growing. It's moving into traditional middle class white collar jobs, which is causing a lot of people to talk more about it. But really, it's for three reasons that it's growing. One is jobs are disappearing. The second is full-time employees are the worker of last resort for a lot of companies. And third is a lot of workers find it really attractive to join the gig economy.
What do you mean workers of last resort?
So what I mean is when companies think about putting together their workforce, full-time employees
are
expensive and they're rigid. So if you look to Silicon Valley and you look at a lot of the most high-growth, highly valued companies in our economy, their business model is one in which there's a core group of full-time employees surrounded by an ever-changing dynamic swirl of contractors, consultants, freelancers, and that really is the business model of the future. We're seeing, you know, Facebook and Twitter, they have 2,500, 5,000, 10,000 employees. We're not seeing GEs coming, developing that have 300,000 employees.
So
very different model.
I wonder, what do you think is driving this growth then? Is it more on the part of the workers or the employers? Are the employers looking at this and saying, hey, this is a way we can really reduce costs. We don't have to go to those rigid full-timers all the time. We can make it more project-based. We need to get this done. We hire people, we get it done. We're not obligated to keep them on. Or is it both of these things combining at once to create this growth?
It's both of those things combining.
Who's the bigger driver, do you think?
I don't know that there is a bigger driver. I think it really is both sides of the equation. I think that there are a lot of people that are very interested in an alternative to full-time work. Every study shows that workers are disengaged, unhappy, unsatisfied, unchallenged in their full-time jobs. And companies are looking for ways to adapt quickly, to bring on new skills as they need them, and to cut costs.
Right. But what about that lack of predictability? And the lack of benefits is probably the biggest thing. Those are tied to full-time work. If you don't work full-time, you don't get health insurance, right? I mean, isn't that the traditional thinking? Is that changing?
I think that's the traditional narrative.
Right.
First of all, I think there is job security is gone. So there is, unless you're a full-time tenured professor, your job is not secure at any time. It can be eliminated, automated, outsourced, offshored, contracted out. So once you come to terms with that, you realize actually taking a job and putting all of your sort of labor eggs into the one company basket is actually quite risky. You're better off having more than one source of income, more than one having a broader portfolio of gigs.
You know, I want to play a little bit of tape here. We've obviously been talking about the economy, changes in the economy, folks not working the traditional 9-to-5 job for a long time, we in the public radio community. And we heard from a woman named Diane Gowder, who's a 65-year-old member of the gig economy. She spoke with KPCC in California this year. And she got laid off from her job in 2005, and she became a sales rep for an eyewear company, working on commissions instead of having a salary. And she said she doesn't think she's going to have enough to retire based on that. Here is how she described the shift for her. Let's listen.
It was a huge switch. I didn't have a steady income. It was up, it was down at certain times of the year, particularly Christmas. Nobody wants to see you at Christmas. I wish I was an employee. I wish I had benefits, and I wish I didn't have to worry about it.
So, Diane, what do you say to people who are workers like Diane?
Yeah, well, as I said, I think that even if you are in a full-time job and you have a steady salary, that is not secure. It's very risky to place, you know, to really count on that and rely on that for stability, particularly over any kind of medium to long-term time frame. I think in terms of benefits, the Affordable Care Act really did change the game for that, because now if you're an independent worker, you can get health insurance on your own, which you used to have a full-time job in order to access health insurance. So I think that's been a game changer. In terms of saving for retirement, you're actually better off if you're an independent worker, because you can save so much more and so much faster for retirement than if you are an employee.
Why?
Well, because
you don't have a certain income, so you have to, you know, there's a difference. You're not budgeting necessarily, so you've got to make enough to pay your mortgage and your bills, right? And
okay, if you have a mortgage, but you have to manage your finances differently. But the opportunity to save more and faster is available to you as an independent worker. Under the current retirement savings rules, independent workers can save up to around, depending on your situation, $50,000 a year towards retirement, whereas if you're a full-time employee, you're capped at about $18,000, again, depending on your circumstances.
You say it's risky for folks to only think of a full-time career as safe and secure, right? A full-time job as being safe and secure. What should folks who maybe have that now think of instead that might be better for them, do you think?
Well, what I talk about in the book is moving from this idea of job security, which no longer exists, to income security. So for workers today, and what I tell my students is, rather than thinking about how can I get a job and how can I rely on a company for my financial security, which is very risky, think more about how can I develop the skills and expand my network and create opportunities so that I can always generate the income I need to support the lifestyle that I choose.
I want to remind listeners that we want to talk to you about the gig economy. Are you working in the gig economy? Do you think it's a wave of the future, or is it a way for employers to reduce labor costs? Call us with your comments at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Bobby is calling from Cambridge. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hey there. I just wanted to make a comment that this is definitely the wave of the future for people who are flexible enough to be able to do freelance work in whatever industry that they're in. Personally, I was at an IT startup about 10 years ago as a network engineer, and I got promoted to an account manager, which allowed me to do work from home. I then transitioned into a work-at-home contractor for the company I worked for, and was able to essentially brand myself as a high-level account manager in IT for that company and for freelance work as well. Mm-hmm. And it really worked out well for me today. I'm not in IT anymore, but I'm an audio engineer. I have taken the skills that I learned going through that, and now I'm an on-demand or freelance worker in the audio industry.
And I'm wondering, Bobby, do you feel nervous at all? I mean, do you feel insecure, or do you feel more in control of your financial future? What does it make you feel like? We've heard some people are nervous. They wish they had a predictable job with benefits and things you go to. Others say that, no, they like the flexibility, and they feel more in control. Where are you on that?
So I was definitely nervous 10 years ago when I was just starting out, because I did not have as much experience selling my brand or my skills. I definitely look at it from a brand sort of angle. I'm at the point now where I can fall back on any of the skills that I've developed over the last 10 years if one thing isn't working. You know, some months I don't have as much audio work as I do technical work and vice versa. So I'm not really at the point anymore where I'm nervous about my financial stability. I've kind of been through that fire and come out on the other end, which very few issues. I mean, I own my own home. I'm extremely happy in my life. You know, I don't know what to say. I don't have that. Those feelings.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Diane Mulcahy. Do you think that Bobby's right here in terms of having to brand himself and being able to sort of build on his name to be able to create that financial stability in his own life that maybe a full-time job might have afforded him before, but now he's doing it on his own?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you tell your students that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the gig economy, you really are responsible for creating, you know, the brand of you, the company of you, however you want to talk about it. But you are as good as your last gig, and you have to always be thinking about what are the skills that I can be developing that are in demand in the marketplace? How can I expand my work, my network, and create future opportunities?
I'm going to take another call here. Pam is calling from Newton. Pam, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was wondering if the speaker could address the fact that there's a common misperception among employers that if they simply call somebody a worker as opposed to an employee, they somehow can escape responsibility for paying their fair share of the taxes, the appropriate wages, commissions, etc. There's something known as a control factor test, which basically in plain terms, you look like an employee and walk like an employee and talk like an employee, then the employer can't call you a contractor and avoid paying you. And in fact, there's, in Massachusetts anyway, it would be a violation of various laws if they avoided paying you your full wages and benefits. So I'd be curious if the speaker could address that.
Yeah, I think that's a big issue.
Yeah.
When I was researching, I have a policy chapter in the book, and when I was researching, you know, the labor market structure and the division between contractors and employees, it became very clear that there are numerous definitions for what a contractor is and what and how you think about classifying an employee. And the problem is there are many definitions, none of them are clear, and they conflict with each other. So employers are really in a tough spot. My take on this really is that we have designed a labor market structure where it essentially penalizes you if you don't have a full-time job. So full-time employees are, you know, given the maximum kind of salary, benefits, protections, rights. And if you're not a full-time employee, you immediately start to lose all of those things. And I think with the growth of the gig economy and increasing numbers of workers choosing to work in the gig economy, either on the side or as part of a full-time portfolio of gigs, we need to really think about a labor market that supports all workers, no matter when, where, how, or how much you choose to work. And I think the problem with the labor market structure today is we're stuck trying to fit this round peg of current workers into this square hole of outdated labor laws.
There's a related question here. Jessica is calling from Tewksbury. Jessica, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I was just wondering, my husband was for a long time and still kind of is considered a contractor in sort of the gig economy. And what we've noticed as we're trying to buy a house is that the banks don't really like to give mortgages to people who don't have a steady full-time 9-to-5. So how would you deal with, you know, if you're telling young people that that's the better option, how do they then approach that when it comes time for them if they would like to buy a house? How would they deal with that kind of thing?
Okay, how do they get credit and things, Diane, an income?
Yeah, yeah. That's such a good question, because as I was just talking about these outdated labor laws and labor market structure, I would say also that the financial services industry has not caught up to this at all. And if you're trying to get a mortgage and you're working in the gig economy, it can be a challenge because banks are still looking at this one model of a W-2 income. what I found when I did interviews for the book, what I found people saying was that they had more success with local community banks that that understand the local market, that get to know their customers really well, and that have a little more flexibility to create mortgages and loans and other financial solutions for people who are not in a traditional full-time job. I also discuss in the book that, you know, what the gig economy is really causing people to question is the whole idea of home ownership and how prevalent that is going to be, at least the way we know it today, as the gig economy continues to grow.
How prevalent it's going to be?
Yeah, I mean, home ownership is on the decline.
Mm-hmm.
And the gig economy could accelerate that because it's harder to take on a highly leveraged fixed cost right. if you have a variable income.
Right. You know, I want to bring up something that the Harvard economist Larry Katz talked about when he spoke about the gig economy. He actually spoke on our show here at WBUR On Point about this, and he said that the gig economy helps drive income inequality. We pulled a clip from that show, and I want to take a listen to it now.
About a third of the growth of inequality in the U.S. economy over the last couple decades appears to be from this fissuring of the workplace. It used to be that if you were at a big company like General Motors or Goldman Sachs or Harvard University, you shared when they were doing very well. Now, if you're an independent contractor or they can threaten to contract out, you no longer share in those benefits.
That's Harvard economist Larry Katz. Diane Mulcahy, what do you say to that? I mean, is there something to say about income inequality and how, you know, how do we restructure things to make sure that that is not what's happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the gig economy is not a panacea. I think in our jobs economy, we have income inequality between, you know, professionals and people in traditionally bad jobs. In the gig economy, equally, there are winners and losers. So there are people who move from traditional full-time jobs into the gig economy and work as contractors and freelancers and are much better off. They have, you know, they are able to generate much more income. They have more flexibility, more autonomy. They're more satisfied. They're more challenged. So they're really the winners in the gig economy. But equally, there are people who have gone from traditional middle-class jobs and are now in contractor roles that don't pay them as much, that don't give them as satisfying work, that they are less challenged, less interested, and in more precarious situation. Mm-hmm. So it really depends.
I want to make sure we can get some more calls in here. David is calling from Jamaica Plain. David, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Yeah. Relevant to that last point, I'm worried that the speaker here is really just describing another form of old-fashioned exploitation and giving it a glossy new word and asking us to downgrade our expectations for the kind of income and the kind of life we're going to live. So I'm really curious. I mean, did you talk to folks who are already in stable jobs with low incomes, or is this really just speaking to high-wage earners already who now just get to, you know, work from home? It seems like nothing good for the most of us.
So you're saying this is for high-wage earners who have the ability, really, and the circumstances to be able to brand themselves to make a maybe more lucrative living and more flexible living than they would otherwise, and those similar things would not be available to folks who are lower down on the income totem pole, if you will. Is that what you're saying, David?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're speaking, this is great if you're able to save $18,000 to $50,000 a year. Are you kidding me? I mean, for most of us, that's just so out of the range of possibility. So to say that makes the gig economy better for people seems kind of out of touch.
Okay. Diane, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point. I think, you know, I did talk to, as part of writing the book, people who are in a wide range of jobs. And what I found was there are plenty of bad jobs to go around in the current economy. And by bad jobs, I mean jobs that are insecure, in which workers are poorly paid, they have no benefits, they have no control. So think about fast food workers, retail workers, people in jobs like that. What happens is in the gig economy is that those workers actually have the opportunity to move from those bad jobs into better work, meaning that they are still in work that is insecure, that isn't well paid, that doesn't give them benefits, but now they have control, autonomy, and flexibility. So the example I like to use is, you know, there's hardly a line of people who are anxious to become taxi drivers, which is a job that meets all those criteria, but there are a lot of people that are willing to become Uber drivers. And even though it is insecure, not well paid, there's no benefits associated with it, they have control over where, when, how, and how much they work. And so the gig economy opens up opportunities for lower paid workers to access work in a way that meets their personal lifestyle and allows them to kind of fill in the gaps and earn money. So there are, it's not all the way there. Clearly, this is still an issue in our economy, but it's a move in the right direction.
And overall, in our last minute here, what advice do you give your students? How do you brand and create a resume? And what do you tell your parents? I mean, what are some of the key strategies that you tell your students?
I mean, I address all of those in the book, and I have a lot of exercises that I have tested on my students to go through and actually come up with a gig economy plan for how to succeed. But I think the biggest step is to change the mindset from, you know, one where you're an employee, where you outsource your professional development, your financial security, your stability to a company, to an opportunity mindset where you really take control of that.
All right. Diane Mulcahy, author of The Gig Economy, The Complete Guide to Getting Better Work, Taking More Time Off, and Financing the Life You Want. She's an adjunct lecturer at Babson College, where she created and teaches the MBA class Entrepreneurship in the Gig Economy. Diane, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new memoir of love and loss in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to go back into our archives now and listen to an excerpt of an NPR report from 1981. By reporter Lori Garrett. It's NPR's first report on a mysterious disease that some called a cancer that was striking young gay men in cities across the country.
In the last 3 months, 28 cases of Kaposi's sarcoma have been reported in this country, all occurring among gay men, most of them young. Every man suffering from Kaposi's sarcoma also has an unusual viral infection. It's called cytomegalovirus, and it may be connected to this puzzling new cancer outbreak.
That puzzling cancer, of course, was AIDS, and the disease went on to claim the lives of some 34 million people over the years. But back in 1981, it was little known and even less understood. That was the year that Michael Ward met Mark Halberstadt. They fell in love, and after 3 years together, Mark was diagnosed, becoming one of the earliest clients of Boston's AIDS Action Committee. Michael Ward writes about this in his new memoir titled The Sea is Quiet Tonight. And Michael Ward joins us in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So paint the picture for us, if you would, what it was like when you met Mark back in the early 80s, and why did he stand out to you?
I met him at something called Tea Dance, which is a big outdoor dance in the Pines in Fire Island. And there was just something about him. He was small and wiry and very self-contained, which is, I'm much more extroverted. And there was something very appealing about that. And he very cleverly moved me out of the crowd and out for a walk. And it went on from there.
Mm. And how old were you then?
I was 37 and he was 39.
And what was sort of the atmosphere like then? Describe what it was like to be a 30-something gay man and at that time, you know? It certainly was very different.
It was very different. 81 was so different. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest with a lot of homophobia. Mm-hmm. And I got involved in New York in the gay rights movement. And we fought very hard for what we felt were our rights. And that also translated in, I mean, liberation translated into sexual and excessive behavior, let me say. Mm-hmm. And I had been in one relationship for 4 years, which had ended not bitterly, but ended. And I was still, I'm a relationship kind of guy. I mean, I was still looking for the right man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the time, would you say that, you know, it was openly hostile? I mean, what was the environment like? And there are a lot of people who may not remember what it was like in 1981.
Just there was a lot of homophobia. When I moved to Boston in 79 from Princeton, I was assaulted the first weekend that I was in Boston on the street. I was walking down the street with my former partner who had helped me move, and I had my hand on his shoulder, and a guy stopped his car and got out and came out swinging. And I stepped in front of Frank to block him, and he broke my glasses. And I was just shocked. I mean, I'd never experienced anything like that before.
Oh, my God.
Boston was full. I was spit on in those early years. People threw beer bottles. If we'd be waiting in line to go into a bar, they'd throw beer bottles. There was a lot of overt, hostile, abusive behavior.
And that was here, which here was considered, not, you know, certainly we're not talking, you know, some backwater place.
It wasn't anything. Little Rock. It was Boston. Yeah.
Right. So I can't imagine then what it was like to have to deal with AIDS at the time. So that this is all coming into the awareness at the time. And you're, what were you thinking?
Well, I thought it belonged somewhere else. Really.
What do you mean? Like another country?
Preferably
planet?
Another planet. Yes. But the stories that we heard were about New York and Boston. Mark was from New York, and so he moved up here to live with me. And he knew people. The first people we knew who got sick were, one was a business partner of his. But we didn't know what it was. It was just, oh, my God, Boyd got sick and died in 2 months. And it was bizarre. But when the numbers started mounting up, it became very creepy.
I'm wondering if you could read a passage from your book for us. It's when you and Mark are discussing the possibility that he might have this new disease called AIDS that was sort of in the, that you wished was on another planet.
Yes, yes. So this, in the book, this is just before he was actually diagnosed. He said, "I worry about AIDS." It was the first time he had ever used that word in relation to himself. I could hardly breathe. We can't be having this conversation, I thought. We were lying naked facing each other, and I held his gaze, pushing my panic down. From what I've read, if you had it, you'd know it. None of your symptoms are extraordinary. I know, but this cough isn't going away. My breathing is affected. Maybe it's time to see a specialist. I'm going to call Cesar at his office this afternoon and ask him to get me a referral. Throughout his narration, Mark's voice was without emotion, whether for his own sake or mine, I didn't know. Good idea. Maybe he'll reassure you. I just don't think your symptoms are bad enough. But the black cloud that I'd felt hovering before felt terribly close. We still didn't know anyone personally in Boston with AIDS, but we knew from friends that there had to be 50 or 60 men already diagnosed. The next morning, running too fast along the dirt path on the Cambridge side of the river, I stumbled and nearly fell. I sat down in the grass, panting like a dog. He's not afraid he's going to get AIDS, Mike. He's afraid he already has it. I was soaked with sweat. Oh, dear God, what if he really is sick? I had tried to avoid reading the New York Native articles, believing that they didn't have anything to do with me. Could I really have been blind all these months? Feeling unsteady, I got up and slowly walked back home.
Wow. Very powerful. So would you say that those were common emotions at the time? A lot of denial.
Oh, yes.
People just didn't believe it was. So when you heard these stories about this weird cancer and you saw people that you knew were dying, it still was easy to put it away somewhere. It wasn't going to happen to me. Is that what you were thinking?
It wasn't going to happen to me. And I know this sounds bizarre, but it wasn't going to happen in Boston, even though I had heard stories about people being diagnosed in Boston. The whole thing, I mean, think of an epidemic now starting with a few people and then a few hundred people, and then a few thousand people across the country. And you'd think, oh, this is just, you know, whatever it is, they'll figure it out.
Right. Yeah. He was obviously eventually diagnosed.
Yes.
And you write about visiting him, where you had to go into a room completely get, you know, dressed in almost protective gear,
yes,
if you will. What,
yes,
what was that like?
Very, very creepy. The worst thing, the worst part about it for me was that he was so distressed when we would come in wearing gowns, masks, covers on our head, gloves, and he couldn't tell one person from another. He said he felt like a leper.
Oh, boy. So what kind of support did you find here in Boston at the time?
Miraculously, in terms of timing, Larry Kessler had just started the AIDS Action Committee when Mark was diagnosed. And also, Dr. Jerome Groopman had just moved here from Los Angeles, and he was totally on top of what little anybody knew. So we had very good support from organizations that were just beginning to pull themselves together.
How did the AIDS Action Committee support you then? Is it my correct in this number here, Mark, was the 100th
person in Massachusetts to be diagnosed.
Okay. And so what kind of support did you get from this fledgling agency known as the AIDS Action Committee in the 80s, right?
Well, Larry showed up at the hospital, and which he did with every person who was diagnosed, and asked, what kind of support do you have? What do you need help at home? As the organization got more organized and more developed, you know, they ended up having hundreds and hundreds of volunteers. And but Mark was the first in all of it. He was in the very first People with AIDS group. He was the first person to be on the Mayor's Council on AIDS.
And how long did Mark live from the time of diagnosis until the time he passed?
10 months.
Yeah, so it was very fast.
Very fast. It, in a certain way, it felt like 100 years because we were really in the day every day. And every day we believed that they were going to find a cure until the last month or so.
What about you? Were you concerned for your own health because of this?
I think denial is a very powerful defense in my psychological system. And I felt like I didn't have time. I was so worried about him, and there were so many things he was unable to do that I was sort of creating a life for both of us while he was sick. And as he got sicker, it took more and more energy.
At one point in the book, though, you said you did get a positive return.
I did.
An HIV test.
Yeah.
What happened there, and how did you feel?
I was in the first study group that Robert Gallo did in Washington for the, it was then called HTLV-3 virus. And when I got the test back, I wasn't distraught. I mean, it's very strange. When Dr. Groopman told me, he told me with Mark, and I thought he was coming in to say they had found another drug to keep Mark alive. So when he told me that the news he had was that I was not positive, I was negative, I felt disappointed. I thought it was going to be something else. And then I really, you know, I worried about it occasionally, but I was very busy with him. And then right before Mark died, we found out that the test had been a false positive.
You know, your relationship with Mark, as you write, was tumultuous.
Oh, it was.
How do you think his illness affected that? Would it make you almost closer?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, again, it was a godsend that we had gone into couples therapy and got some really good help in sorting out the difference between someone who is extremely extroverted and somebody who's extremely introverted. And the we were very allied by the time he got his diagnosis. So I never once thought about leaving.
Why write this book now, all these years later?
I needed to write it. I retired 3 years ago, and for all the years, he's been dead almost 33 years now. And that scene in the preface of going to call his parents in the waiting room was in my mind from the day it happened, in terms of, if I ever write about this, that's where I'm going to start. So when I stopped working, it was cathartic for me to go. I had never reread my journals from those years. And I went back and reread everything and did a substantial amount of crying. And then began to put it together and thought, I can do this. I can write a book.
Right. But what about the story? What do you hope the story does for people
now?
Because now, it's a very different time right now.
It's a very different time now.
So do you want to tell them what did AIDS teach the world, or what was it like, or what?
I think more what what was it like, for a couple of reasons. The feedback that I've gotten from people who worked in the epidemic, like Larry Kessler and Peter Lombardi, who was ran the Buddy program, is that they had, like me, they had so much affect depressed and undigested from the epidemic that they cried all through the book. And I think a lot of the survivors who were also caretakers are responding in a very emotional way. But I'm also really interested in young people reading it, because the numbers for adolescents are up 26% for HIV infection.
Oh, really?
Two adolescents a day are being diagnosed in the United States with HIV. Because they believe that now that they know that there are medications you can take, they say, well, I can just take medication. But they don't understand that they're then subject to a lot of other illnesses, and they'll be affected their whole lives.
Okay. Michael Ward, retired psychotherapist, author of the new memoir, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. There's more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.